Abangani, everyone. This is Professor Amin-Ra, Professor Emeritus, California State University of Long Beach, along with my co-host, historian Joe Hembrick, longtime educator in the Compton-Linwood Unified School District and administrator, and one of the first Black head coaches for Linwood Unified School District in football, as well as one of the most prolific studier of Black history and culture and expressions of the truth. We want to welcome you along with Brother Rashiki, who set up the platform, a community education network for us to broadcast this podcast. And we want to thank him and his niece and all the technicians that make this possible. But secondly, we want to say today that many of you are always looking for truth. And we can tell by some of you in your face, you want the truth. Well, tonight, you ain't going to get nothing but the truth. This brother not only research and go out and search for truth, but he lives a true and real life. He's a close friend of mine, as well as an individual that has traveled extensively looking for the truth, the reality of the Black and African experience. I'm talking about Ronnie Foster, street name Duron. Him and Brother Marvin, Starving Marvin, and have helped a lot of people deal with addiction through the 12-step program, one of the longest programs. And himself is a 33-year, if I'm not mistaken, he can correct me, of sobriety. So he lived that life. He lived the street life. But going into sobriety, then he was an entrepreneur, a successful businessman that owned numerous various business, as well as fixed up cars and put them in car shows. So he has an extensive background, but he recently went to Ghana, where he spent, I don't know, a month. And he performed poetry and discussed the Black experience in America, in Ghana, to the Ghanaians who would listen. And then he brought back their experience to us and explained the reality of the conditions in Ghana from the standpoint of his vantage point of living over there and sharing food and all the other cultural exchanges. He brought me back an outstanding booba, and I want to say Asante Sana for that. I love it, and I can't wait till this pandemic is over so I can don it and go out and hang out with it. But anyway, we're going to let Brother Ronnie Foster come in and tell you a little bit more about his personal coming up and who he is, about his outstanding being an author. He has two. He has volume one and volume two of the Revolution in Progress books, a book of his poetry, authentic poetry that comes straight from his mind based upon his experience. So, Brother Ronnie, you take it over. Tell us a little bit more about you and then get to explain. And then I'm just going to tell you briefly the platform. We let you talk. And talk about your experiences in the various areas that you would like to go in. First, talk about yourself, who you are, so the people who will eventually watch this know this, and the people on who may not know you get to know you. Second, that you discuss your books and all the other information that you think is pertinent to people getting an understanding of why you do what you do, and why you are a true teacher, speaker, and an excellent poet, as well as a literary man and author. So without further delay, Brother Ronnie Foster, which is one of our premier guests, and we're thankful for him taking time to be on the Conscious Corner, which was named that was coined by Brother Joe Hembrick. Thank you. Go ahead, Brother Ronnie.
All right. Hello, everybody. And it's such a pleasure to be invited somewhere, you know, that has not always been the case with me, but my grandfather was a minister in Louisiana, and I only got a chance to meet him as a little boy, and he was 90 years old then. And my grandmother on my mother's side was a holy roller. And so I was really indoctrinated with with the Christianity upcoming. But however, my father and his siblings, my father had bookie joints, and he was a hustler type. You know, that's how we ate, is through betting horses and shooting dice and things of that nature. And my father actually walked the soldiers to the prostitutes and got quarters and saved his quarters. And then he got he built two shoe shine stands. But while that was going on, he had a brother that was 8 years old, which was actually 15 years older than my father. But at 8 years old, my uncle was forced to leave home from Louisiana because he talked back to white folks. He did not like or condone the white supremacy that was being put on him and his family. And his mother and my 90-year-old granddaddy forced him to leave and said that the white people were going to kill him because he talked back and they weren't going to tolerate that. So they sent him to California. And when he got to California, he's 8 years old, he had a sister that was here that had came. So he stayed with his sister. But during that time, coming up, some kind of way, I don't know, because I wasn't born anything, but he got hold to ancient Black history books, and he started learning about Queen of Sheba, Queen Hatshepsut, Hannibal, reading the Book of the Dead. And the more he read, the more he wanted to know. And eventually going into J.A. Rogers, Chancellor Williams, and Albert Churchwarden, reading all those books. And so as he got older, you know, he started wearing all kind of fancy clothes and custom-made shoes and Cadillacs, and he invested in racehorses. Well, quite naturally, he was a pimp. So that is the product that my grandfather produced, you know, but everybody had something that they had to do for a living. And so that was the environment that I was basically raised in. But however, as I was born and came up, my mother and father did not want me to have that kind of lifestyle. So they tried to do everything in their power to get me differentiated from out of that. And so that's, you know, my basic upbringing. But me, myself, personally, we moved to Compton real early in life, you know, when I was about like 3 or 4 years old. And so my father had started all these bookie joints and everything. And I started, you know, I had 3 sisters that were older than me, and I had a bunch of nephews. And so my sisters were grown when I was born. You know, so I used to run around my nephews, but I was sent to El Segundo Elementary School, George Washington Elementary School, and I didn't really do that well in school because I wanted to hang out with my friends and do everything that I want to do. My mother and father was constantly telling me that they wanted me to be something more than what they were, so they tried to send me to a private schools, and I didn't want to be there. So when you don't want to do something, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. I threw glasses at drinking glass at passing cars to get kicked out of school. So they say, well, he's going to be what he's going to be. So what they did make me do was have a tutor. And the tutor taught me phonics, taught me fractions, and all the things that I needed for to basically be able to get by in my life. So with that being said, you know, just my attitude alone, quite naturally, I became a drug addict myself, you know, trying to be hip, slick, and cool and hanging out with my friends from, you know, at the age of 13. But I had my own car at the age of 13 that I had accumulated from shooting dice at the boogie joints, going to the racetrack. I did those things that, you know, I wouldn't go into school, so I would hang out with the horses at the horse stables and, you know, just... I had different exposures where I was able to do them things, but I had my own car, so I was able to go them kind of places. And so my uncle you know, start requesting that I come around him more and things like that. And, you know, I would go with him every day to take care of the horses. And I had wind up getting a horse myself. My father actually had diesel truck. He, you know, he just had entrepreneur spirit himself. You know, he took his bookie money and he bought diesel trucks. And then after that, he started buying race horses himself, you know. So I actually just started, you know, hanging out with him. And I had enough time to spend around him where he would start telling me about Queen of Sheba and Queen Hatshepsut and Black Hannibal and Cleopatra. And I had a chance to, listen to him and start reading those books and start picking up that kind of experience, you know. So anyway, to make a long story short, he kept telling me everybody has something they do for a living, you know, and the different things that I had to go through in my little particular life, because I was getting in all kinds of trouble. You know, I was a moderate drug user using marijuana. I started off with marijuana, you know, and I liked the effects of the PCP and the angel dust and all the, you know, both on both sides of me were drug dealers and where I stayed at. And so I was exposed to that. And I always hung around the kids that was older than me. You know, if I in seventh grade, I'd be hanging with the 12th graders and people that was out of school, and they would let me, you know. So, you know, just with that being, that's the kind of attitude, you know, and things that I grew up with. But my uncle, you know, he really pressed me about everybody has something they do for a living. And he was trying to get me, you know, he'd become a horse trainer or at least find out what I want to do. But I was lucky enough, I had a friend who his father was a jockey, and I have extensive horse background. And my friend, we were young and we were on the racetrack with the horses. And he always said that he was going to be a veterinarian and I would be his assistant. And he stuck with that. And he is the surgeon right now at Santa Anita. And he himself writes the tests for the United States veterinarian program for the vets to get out. So, but by him telling me that I would be his assistant, I went to respiratory therapy school because I didn't have the education or the knowledge to go to college. So I did the next best thing. And I was able to take that respiratory knowledge, knowing that the human being wasn't too far from the horse because they both got eyes, nose, mouth, teeth, ears. They all are animals, you know, just on different bases. So I went to respiratory school, and sure enough, the lungs are the same. They're just a little larger, you understand? So I worked at the hospitals and trauma centers, and I was a respiratory therapist. I've seen some of everything that a human being could see happen to another human being. I've seen people with their brains blowed out. I've seen open heart massages. I've seen people stabbed. People throw out the car, a moving car on the freeway, and just things like that, you know. But that was my line of work, and that's what I had to do. And so, you know, everything that I learned, I was actually self-taught because I like to read, and my uncle really instilled that into me, you know, that, you know, you must be fully self-supporting and learn for yourself. So, The saltwater aquarium business that I started with you guys in the city of Compton, I'm so glad, you know, that I always liked fish as a little kid. And so as I got a little older, when I would be working in those hospitals, on my spare time, I'd read those marine aquarium books and tell all about the photosynthesis and the things that would take place in the aquariums and in the ocean. I've been scuba diving in about 7 different oceans, you know, just to learn what I needed to learn and understand about trying to raise those fish and the corals and things like that, you know. And I read those books until all those books that I read start saying the same thing. And when that happened, I said, well, I guess I'm ready. So I started the saltwater aquarium business, you know. And then by me working in the hospital, having to wear those scrubs and stuff, I started making my own custom-made scrubs out of denim because I would be in the streets so much that it's time to go to work. Oh, shit, I got to go to work. I didn't have time to change clothes. So the scrubs that I designed were made from denim, and you could wear them in the streets, and I could wear them to work. So I designed the whole clothing line from that, you know. And I had a thing that we call Blue Forest Farms. Now, Blue Forest Farms, where I had sheep, goats, turkeys, peacocks, because I have an extensive background, let's say, with horses and animals. So I knew how to take care of the animals. So when I started that with the aquarium business, and the little kids in the neighborhood, for some reason, started coming over there because of all the animals and seeing all the fish. And I lived in Compton, where the business was in Compton, and it was around the corner from a liquor store. And all these parents at this liquor store would be over there drinking, and the kids would be, you know, over there. They make them a makeshift basketball court with the milk crate. You know, they put the milk crate on the a 2x4 and put it up there. And the kids would actually start wouldn't stay there at the liquor store. They start coming around where I was at, and they keep coming. And I started knowing all the little kids in the neighborhood, man. So when I got them sheep, goats, turkeys, and peacocks. And the kids start coming over there religiously, and they start learning responsibilities, how to clean up behind the animals, and would be punctual. I'll be back tomorrow. And they'd be there, you know. So I thought that was a great thing. So we started a program from that. And that was really something, you know. People pass by and in their car, what the hell was that, a pig? You know, I was getting ready to get llamas and everything. But anyway, that's just some of the things that I have been through. And my life has not been a bad life. Anything that happened bad in my life is self-inflicted. You know, I'm my self-worst enemy. And I've learned that down through the years, you know. So only thing I can say, all the things that my mother told me to do the right things, and I didn't have to do shit in the first place when all I had to do the things to do the right thing in the first place, I'm telling those same things to my kids right now, you know. So anyway, that's about me, you know, for the most part. You want me to go on and what else should I talk about?
You got to unmute, Rob.
Talking about the trip to Africa.
Yeah, okay.
Your travels and how you went to Ghana and and other places you've been. And
okay.
And I really, I like that Ghana experience when you sent the material back and sent you having lectures there on a podium and things of this nature. And you just spoke at the Malcolm X festival along with the Umar Johnson, is that his name?
Yeah, Umar Johnson. Yeah, Dr. Umar. Yeah.
And you took a picture with him and y'all had a good time. So just go into, especially the Ghana, how long you stayed there, and, you know, what did you learn about the continent of Africa?
Okay, well, this is what happened. I have been reading about Africa ever since I was 13 years old due to my uncle. He would make me read these books, as I was saying, by J.A. Rogers, learning about octoroons, quatroons, and the mulattoes. And then I'd read Destruction of the Black Civilization, and just all the different books. And so I've always had a fascination with Africa. And after I got older, you know, to where I am now, I did not want to go to my grave as a Black man in America and never see Africa. So about 10 years before this, I took a trip to Egypt. A friend of mine and I went to Egypt, and it was very eye-opening, you know, just to see all the things that was in that museum that they had got out of those graves, you know, from the ancient ancestors, you know, and put them in the museum. So, but I didn't really get it. And that was more of a tourist experience, you know. So I really had this thing, I need to see Africa. I want to see Africa. And it's always been ride me and always been in me to go see Africa. And I fooled around, you know, as I said, my parents were gamblers and that's how we ate. But my father used to say, I'm on the don't side. You know, he'd be the house, you know, he didn't bet that they do. He bet they don't, you know? And so I play poker. And so I was playing poker and we hit what they call a jackpot. So on the jackpot, I took my money from the jackpot and I said, well, look like I'm gonna get a chance to go to Africa. I'm gonna take this money and I'm going to Africa. And I had been following this brother, My Natural Roots on Instagram. And I've been watching him growing his own food. That's another thing that I didn't mention. I've been a plant-based eater for over 17 years, you know, by me working in the hospitals, seeing all the death and the destruction and the cancer and people waiting to the last moment to come to the hospital. And I figured they all had one thing in common. It had to be the food. So I eventually weaned myself off and off and off. And finally, I became a plant-based eater after meeting a friend of mine. And so with that, I started growing my own food. And then I met a guy named Adonijah, who actually is he grows his own soil. And the soil is what you use, or the plants use, to get the nutrients. So we have to learn how to grow the soil. And then once you grow the soil, the plants have nutrients in the soil that they can draw from, you know. So I learned in vermiculture, you know, with the worms oxygenating the soil and all those kind of things. So I did that. So I grew my own food. And I done got off. Oh. Yeah. So I always wanted to go to Africa. So I hit the jackpot and I took that money and I said, well, I'm going to go to Africa. But I had met the guy. He was giving tours. It was his first tour. He's a young man. He's giving his first tour on Africa. I said, you know what? I'm going to on that tour with him. So I called him and said, man, you only got like 2 weeks or something left. You got to get a visa. So he told me what to do. I sent everything in and they sent it back to me. I said, oh boy, I'm going to Africa. So that's what happened. And I got all my things together. It was only a 2-week trip. Now I had been writing this book, Revolution in Progress, for 2 years. Mr. Omari and I getting it together. And I had an incident where a guy told me, I wanted him to do the artwork in the book for me. And he told me after he used to do the artwork for Tupac and everything. And he was from Compton. I said, well, that's good. Cause you know, this is a black book. It should be produced by black people and have black artists and stuff in it. So when I went to him and I told him, you know, what we had lunch, sat down, and I told him everything I wanted to do. I shot a couple of poems on him, told him what I wanted. And he came back and looked at me and said, brother, don't you think this book is too black? I said, huh? He said, yeah. Don't you got any white friends? I said, huh? I do, but I don't tell them what I'm thinking, you know? So he said, well, brother, I got white business association things and I'm not trying to go down, you know, bad in their eyes and things like that. So I don't think I better have anything to do with this book. You know, you go find you another artist. So with that, I wrote a poem called Too Black, you know, which I was glad it happened. You know, that helped me put another page in my book. So I said, okay, fine. I'm gonna publish this book in Ghana when I get there. Because I had been to Indonesia before and I started my own clothing line and found my people to sew the clothes for me and everything. So I wasn't a stranger to going to strange countries by myself and finding and getting what I need to do for myself. So I say, I'm going to produce this book in Ghana. That's where we're going to publish it there. So I get all my little stuff that I need, and I jump on the airplane. I go to Ghana by myself. You know, I just knew it was going to be okay, you know, because my uncle told me with this knowledge, when you get this knowledge and you got this knowledge and it's yours, you can go anywhere in the world and you can survive with your Black ancient history knowledge and bring it all the way up to date. And sure enough, when I get to Ghana, they meet me at the airport. And there's a young lady on this van, you know, on the van that we get. So it's nighttime. You can see some things, but in certain places it's dark because they, you know, it's not a lot of lights, but it's not really dark, but some places. So what they did, they had this dinner lined up for us when we got there, you know, and they take us to this house. Now, you know, here in America, we're taught that Africa, you know, is anything but what it is, really. I mean, you know, Africa got the world's massive traffic jams, you know, more cars in Africa than anywhere on earth. you know, and tell you that it's huts and they run around with bones in their nose and diapers and these kind of things, you know. So when I get here, they take us to this house. So when we go in this house, they tell us that we're going to eat. And they got all this food spread out. Anything that you eat, they got meat. They got vegetables. They got vegan food. They got anything you think you can eat. But when I look, it's granite table. Brand new house, big flat screen TVs. And then I find out this home is on the ocean and it's owned by African-American couple. And they got this big wall where everybody that come through them doors sign on this wall, you know? And I understood Mr. Hembrick earlier to say that he hung around older people himself. And me, myself, I've hung around older people. When I was in seventh grade, I was with 12th graders. Never hung around nobody my age. And I don't know why, it was just something that was in me. But now I get to Africa. And when I get to Africa, I learn that Africa is a young country, you know. So they really believe in their ancestors like we do God. You understand? I mean, you have proof that your ancestors are here because you're here. And so they do prayers to the ancestors. They have altars set up for their ancestors. So what they did, when they got ready to bless the food, they made everybody go around and tell their story, why they came to Africa. Okay, then when they finish, they say, okay, the oldest person here has to do the blessing to the ancestors. And I'd be damned if I wasn't the oldest person. I cry. I'm about to cry now just to think about it. You understand? And that was something I've never been taught about, the ancestors. You know what I'm saying? We don't learn that here. So I spoke and blessed the food and everything. And then they told us that this was a beach house. This home was on the ocean. They take us out to the ocean. And then we go out to the ocean to see where the slaves crossed. Where the slaves crossed the ocean. But I didn't know that the slave dungeon was less than a half a mile away from there, from where we were at, because that's why we're going on this tour, to see the slave dungeons and everything. So that in itself right there was just experience for me, learning about the ancestors and how they respect the elders, you know. And so now the next day, we go to the slave dungeons. And when we get to these slave dungeons, we go inside, these big old cast. Well, let me back up a little bit. We're on our way to the slave dungeons. And the guide that was driving the truck, they stopped and asked, hey, which way is the slave dungeons? And so it was like five or six police. And the police say, oh, wait. And they went and they huddled and they had a talk and they come back and say, oh, you want British castles? You want the British castles? They are whatever. They say, no, I didn't say the British castles. I said the African slave dungeons. You know, let's get that straight. We're not going to glorify the British castles. Those are African slave dungeons. So I really thought that was something that resonated with me right there. So when we get to these slave dungeons, and we go on this tour, and they start when we go inside where they actually had the slaves, and what they had back then, they had ditches carved out for the feces, the urine, and that's just in the Cape Coast dungeon. The other dungeons didn't have those. This was the latest one, and so that's what they, you know, they had these gutters, as I say, for the feces, the urine, and the things like that. And then they also had, you know, and so we go in there and they would tell the stories of how they colonialized the Africans, that they had two big Christian churches across the street from the slave dungeon. And in those churches, they would brainwash and whitewash the Africans to Christianity because, you know, Christianity is like 2,000 years old. You know, the Caucasian himself is like 6,000 years old, but they done found bones in Africa a million years old. What does that tell us? You know, just right there. So and they're telling these stories, you know, about how they would take the rebellion slaves and the weak ones and then, you know, starve them to death and kill them in front of the rest of the slaves and then bring the other brainwashed Africans in that was coming from the church. And then they had a church that was on top of the slave dungeon that was inside the dungeon where they would really instill that you know, the slaves were in such bad conditions, they would hear, you know, them praying to God and preaching and all these type of things. And so when they sent them off on the ocean trip, that they would be already Christianized, you know. And so yeah, that's what they did. So anyway, now that is 2022. When you go into slave dungeons, they have these altars set up for the ancestors and everything, you know, where you can, you know, bring homage and sacrifices for the ancestors.
Tell them what made you stay for 2 weeks, 3 months.
Okay, I will get to here. I come. Here I come. So. As I said earlier, there was this girl on this bus that was in the tour, and all the time, you know, I'm just being me, you know, I'm just differently unique with, you know, with the things I say. I laugh, man, they recorded me just laughing. And it's something crazy. Even like when I shoot dice at the bookie joint, and if I, you know, people, you know, they're serious about their money, I'll just throw the dice up in the air. You know, anything, when it comes down, I'll start, let's say, man, get this so-and-so out of here, man, with that laugh. You know what I mean? But this girl kept telling me, you look like my daddy. You remind me of my daddy. So I said, okay, well, that's good. Okay. I hope your daddy doing good. You know, it's all right. So, you know, and so then we go to this African-American repatriation village that they have there in Ghana. And what they had at this African-American repatriation village was they teach you how to make your own brick. They teach you how to build your own house. They teach you how to grow your own food. They teach you how to cook your vegan meals. And they teach you solar energy. So when you come out of that place as a young man, you're fully self-supported. And I mean, it was something like I've never seen. And I put pictures of it. It looked like igloos in Africa, you know. But, oh, man, the place was real different, you know. And so the girl told me, "You look like my daddy. You sure remind me of my daddy." But there was another brother. I told y'all I grew food. And so I volunteered my time to learn how to plant and grow this food with this brother. I spent almost 2 years with this man, you know, just for free, just so I would know what I was doing and learn how to grow my own food. And when I get to here in Africa, there's this brother that had got these dreads all the way to the floor. And he's the Baba over there that's teaching people how to grow their own food. He's teaching them, you know, how to build the bricks and all these things. But he reminds me of this brother that taught me. So I asked, "Hey, man, do you know Adonijah?" He looked in the sky and he said, "Yeah, from California." I'm like, wow, it's a small world, you know. So in that time, everything, I was real fascinated. We go up to the mountain, the biggest mountain in the Volta region. I couldn't make it up there. I got beat up by the conditions of, you know, I'm an old man. I couldn't hang with them youngsters, you know. And then we go back and we go to the waterfall and just see all the beauty and everything that Africa had to offer. I mean, it was beautiful. We go to the monkey sanctuary, the monkeys jumping all on your arm, eating bananas and all these type of things, you know. And so I knew I wanted to publish this book. So I kind of started looking for book publishing places. And I'd be damned, I found one right on the highway. You know, I said, "Oh, I see one. I'm going to come back." You know, and I think I got their name and I called them or something too. But I was staying in different places, you know, after the tour was over with. I decided that I wasn't going to go back in those 2 weeks. And there was another girl, a young girl there. She decided the same thing and she's still there. But what it wind up happening is I start, you know, because like the hotel that I had was like $16 a night. And if you got $100, it's $600 in Ghana. If you got $1,000, it's $6,000 in Ghana. So I decided that I was going to stay. I wasn't going to go back on this tour, you know. And I started staying in different hotels. You know, one was $16 a night. I stay for a week. I'd move somewhere else in another part so I get another experience, you know. And they tell you that them Africans don't want you. Them Africans don't want to be bothered with y'all, you know. But that's not true. Oh, man, the camaraderie, the love that they had for you, it was beautiful. Now, what I seen when I'm on the streets in Africa, going and all the people got the baskets on their heads and the Africa, home of the entrepreneur. They wake up in the morning and they're getting their things together and they're selling water. They're selling all the goods, whatever they got. You know, if they're selling fresh fruit, it's not 2 miles away from you from where they picked it at. And the fruit is so fresh. Oh, man, you already magically know this stuff over here is poison. It's bad. Man, that fruit give you diabetes over there. Everything, the sweet bananas, you know, just packed with nutrients. And so, you know, they're selling all everything that they got, you know what I mean? Homeward entrepreneur. And get back to where I was thinking.
Hold on for a minute, Duran. Hold on, Duran.
Okay.
I know you got to pick up your son, I think you said. About 8:45. So we're gonna go around and see if anybody have any specific questions they want to ask you about your life or Ghana or your book.
Okay.
And then you can recite a poem if you want to. But Rasha Key, go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to get the title of that book so I could show it if I can, if it's online.
It's not online. I've never done nothing like that before, but
okay, there it is. Revolution in Progress. Okay.
Yeah, it's called The Revolution in Progress. a collection of raw, uncut, conscious poetry. You know, it was some cuss words and stuff in this book, but I'm going to do an edited edition, you know, where I don't have to do that. But, you know, Professor Raw had told me, say, you want to hide something from a Black, you put it in a book, Duran. You know, so with that being said, I say, well, I don't need me hiding nothing. I'm gonna let it rip, you know. So that's where we got to that. So yeah, it's Revolution in Progress, Volume 1 and Volume 2.
Okay.
But I want to see if you anybody have any questions, Sister. Tanisha Hoover, are you there? You're on mute.
I'm here. I have a question for Mr. Forrest. I want to know if you have any other books that you have published, and or if you have any other books that you're thinking about doing after these.
Well, that's a beautiful question, Ms. Hoover. Actually, this is the first book that I ever written or wrote. This is the first book that I published, but I'm in the process right now of telling my father and my uncle's story, who my uncle was a dear friend. They were very best friends of Sammy Davis Sr. And I'm telling that story about the Black Horseman that it started off with Black Hannibal. That's how he was able to win at least sustain the war with his 37 war elephants and the Nubian cavalry. And those Black horsemen came all the way down to the 1800s for the Black jockeys who have won the Kentucky Derby for the first 15 years or so, you know, until they start executing the doctrine of exclusion. You know, no Black should have wealth and be able to pass down to their families and things. So, yes, I have another book. We haven't even gave it a title yet, but it's four different families here in California that were professional horsemen. And we all know each other, and we're generational horsemen. And so I'm telling that story on the next one. Yeah, it should be maybe finished by the end of the year or so.
All right, good. Any other questions, Tanisha?
No, thank you.
Okay, what about Sandra?
Show that book again so we can make sure we have a good picture of it.
Volume 1 and Volume 2.
Good. All right.
Yeah.
All right. Brother Sandra, are you there? You're on mute. Okay, Hendrick, Brother Historian Hendrick, you have any questions?
I don't have any. Well, a couple questions. But first, I'd like to, you know, thank the brothers for coming on. Looked like we had a similar path in growing up. I grew up around some of the same stuff you did. And you know, went through those travels in Compton with the Stums and all of that.
With the Stums.
Question: When you had all these animals, where were you living at in Compton at that time? Were you in Richland Farms or what?
No, you know, there's different parts, man. I was like on 130th in Willowbrook, like 124th, 100th. All those are equestrian and horse properties over there.
Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, and that's another thing. Compton's the only city that has an equestrian city that has to share their horses with the automobiles. All Lakewood, Southgate, all those big places have horses, but they have big enough places where they don't have to put their horses in the streets. They have arenas and stuff, you know. But go ahead.
I'm a reader of all those books you mentioned, Clark, Ben, the author. I got to do one thing that you did, you know, before I check out here, I got to go across the water myself. Something I've been wanting to do. I was going to go in 1991, but I took the job at Centennial and canceled out trying to get the little football thing together. I had a neighbor next door that was from Ghana, his sister, and I was shocked that the strong Presbyterian, you know, religious, you know, shackle that they wear around their necks. And I used to always ask her, I said, how can you be a part of a religion that, you know, that enslaved your people in the first place? You know, that's another story. But anyway, just appreciating what you were talking about. And I tell people all the time, just like you mentioned earlier about, you know, African-Americans believe that the Africans don't want nothing to do with us, which I know that's a lie. And that's who we need to be hooking up with. I think the technology here and all the resources there, you know, we could really do something in the world. Anyway, yeah. I'm going to sign off now and let you, another thing about the food growing, you know, I do the same thing. I got a big old garden in my backyard. I grew 2 crops last year, had a great time sharing with all the neighbors and all of that.
Yeah, and
with this drought going on, I don't know what I'm going to be able to do this year, but I'm going to do something. And I love fishing too. I go deep sea fishing quite often. I keep my freezer full of, you know, reds and white sea bass and all of that, gropers and all of that. So
absolutely.
So anyway, I believe in the African way about the ancestors and all that. Whenever I'm at a big function with my relatives, I always tell them to leave a spot for the ancestors, you know.
And that's dead serious too, man. That's really, that's something that we need to really learn about and pick up on, man. We slacking that.
Right. We slacking a whole lot of it, but we got to get that religious cloak off.
Absolutely. And you're right, man. You're right. When I was there in the slave dungeons and they told us, they said that 80% of the Ghanaians there in Ghana couldn't tell you how many slave dungeons are in Ghana. And I just couldn't believe that. It's only 3, you know, but wow. And it was right on the ocean. And then when I went around to the back, that gutter that I was telling you about with the with the feces and the urine and all that, and I seen the gutter coming out of the slave castle all the way to the ocean. Oh man. That did something to me too. I don't know, but yeah.
Anyway, appreciate your lecture, brother. I'm going to stop right now and let you go on to the next person. Or you continue on with your travels. Tell us about that. Appreciate it.
Peace. All right. Brother
Rossity? Yeah, I have a few questions for him when we go off of here.
Okay, then. Yeah. Well, I got a few questions. Brother, first again, thank you for coming, but a little bit more about your family structure, I had the honor of speaking at your father's transition, and you set up a beautiful Black experience. There was a couple of us that you had invited to speak on consciousness, but you can get into that. But before you get into that, when you were in Ghana, you had on Instagram, or Facebook, of you speaking to the people in Ghana. What were you talking about? And you know, you did do some poetry, but you also talked to them about consciousness. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, what happened was what started it. I was actually know that I wanted to publish this book in Ghana. And I had already been writing this book here. But when I get there, I had met some few friends. And it was a funny thing because when I'm on the street, I noticed there's nobody on the streets with gray hair. Everybody, Africa's a young country. They all got Black hair, and there's young people. And then I'm light-skinned, you understand? And that's, it's not an awful lot of light-skinned people like me, unless they're white, hardly are, you know, just things like that. And then when you open up your mouth and then you have this American accent that, you know, because everybody's trying to sell something. They're not going to hurt you, but they're trying to damn sure sell you something, you know, to just be able to live and survive. So they buy mine. And so with that being said, I go and buy me some pineapple because I don't eat any meat. I've been a plant-based eater. So I go get the fruits and everything that I need and stock up on it. So I would go and I took the motorcycle this particular day and rode on the back. And I jumped off and I heard somebody hollering, "White Mon! White Mon! White Mon, come buy my pineapple, White Mon! White Mon!" I'm like, whoa-wee! He got like 25 people around him and everything, you know. I say, okay, let me go down there. So I go down there. I say, give me 3 pineapple, cut them up for me, and put them in the bag, and how much? So he do everything. I asked him, cut them up, he paying, blah, 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 blah. Then, so when it got, so he kind of laughing and clowning. He feeling good. So then I say, now, would you call an albino a white man? Is an albino a white man? And he looked at, ooh. I say, exactly. Don't you call me a white man. I'm a black African-American. So after that, I was telling some friends about it. And, and some of the Ghanaians that was there, they say, man, so if you hear the word Bruni, Bruni is a white man. So I started noticing because, you know, I'd be walking and they say, Bruni. I said, huh? And so I'll be, and somebody else say, Bruni. I said, ho, what did you say? Bruni. I said, you come back here. And I learned how to say black in tree. So that is Bibini. So I say, me no Bruni. Me Bibini, don't you call me Bruni. I'd be laughing, but I'm just trying to straighten them out a little bit, you know, at least make them conscious of the difference, what is a white man and what is not a white man, you know. We have octoroons, quatroons, mulattoes, you know, and a lot of us need to really know them things, you know. So, well, what happened? I was telling this brother who had this African American Repatriation Center that I was doing these books and I was going to get them published here in Ghana. He said, "Really? Really?" He said, "Man, I think that's beautiful. That's good." And I did a poem for him. He's like, "Oh my God, Africa needs this, man. I think those poems are great." So he said, "We're having a family day or something here, and we would love for you to come and perform some poetry for us. We need to hear this. We want to hear it." I said, "Okay." So I did that, and I think I did two. Yeah, I did that. But then after I had the book published, I came and I did another one and it had a book signing there. And so after I did that, they told me that they would like for me to come back and start speaking at some schools and things, you know. And I told them that I would just let me know whenever they got that together and I would come back and I would speak at the schools. And so that's what I was doing when you seen me on stage. I was performing some of the poetry out of the book. Mm. Yeah.
Okay. So what did you say, though? What poem did you give
him? Well, Professor, I'm going to tell you. You know, I wrote you a poem that you add. You say, man, you got to do something with black folks and revolution. You got to do something with black folks and revolution. So I did Black Folks Are Still Scared of Revolution, which is the poem I wrote for you. You know, I wrote one for LeGrand and I wrote one for you. Okay. And that's what I did. And I had put a whole thing together where I actually did like 3 or 4 poems together where I talked about Malcolm X and Bunchy Carter, Fred Hampton, and Sandra Bland, and the list as long as a train that can literally just drive you insane just to know the trickery that has been put into the reins of the system, you know? And with that, I went on and I did the poems that I actually put into the book.
You want to do one?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, this one is called, this is your point. This is what I, this is the one I wrote for you. Black folks are scared of revolution. Black folks are scared of revolution. Black folks are still scared of revolution. It's about change. Try your diet. If in poor health, Black folk rather die from a food-related illness rather than change their diets. The revolution is being televised right in front of our eyes. Do we realize it's despising about racism and white lies that we let fly? Man up, Black. This ain't tit for tat or even chit chat. Holiness, Baptists, Catholics are all Christianity. And in the forefront of world domination, degradation, humiliation, and trickery, the Blacks have been booted. Our minds have been looted and polluted from centuries of whitewash interwoven into our souls. You can fall to your knees and beg and plead, but it all falls on deaf ears because that won't help you here. Even if you fall to your palms with Islam, the revolution is about change. Ask your ancestors and your fallen peers. All that's left here is tears. Tell me, Black, what is your fear? So that was that one. And I got, do I got time to do the one I did for LeGrand?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, I'll do the one I did for LeGrand. Now this one deals more with the Albert Church Ward and how we came to be on the earth as being Black people. This one is called Evolution of Hate. See, because you cannot take two whites and make a Black, but you can damn sure take two whites, two Blacks and make a white. And we won't fuss or fight and because this knowledge here has been erased from sight. And so this is Evolution of Hatred. The great ancient Akabulan, land of the Blacks. Some tribes there, pygmies and Notic Negroes who had exodus all over the globe before there was ever a white person in sight. They never had to fuss or fight, didn't even exercise wrong from right. It was in love, trust, harmony, and muscles and might. And even the wild animals would warn before they bite. The tribes of this great kingdom had only seen few whites. They numbered only in the teens of these white human beings. They were the albinos from their own Black race. So rare there in that place, and still yet the great kings made them their pets and assigned them an overseer to keep them in check. Now the old pharaohs would jump off their thrones when they see these little albinos coming along. The little white seeds began to breed. They made a plenty, damn near too minty. The pets were looking at all the glimmer, the glamour, at the Blacks swinging the hammer, looking at pygmies, pyramids, diamonds and gold, iron and copper and things to be traded in more. Astronomy, mathematics, and chemistry, too, when looking at those masters, not knowing what to do. They began to chitter and chatter, and the way of Black life, it started not to matter. They began to lie, steal, causing havoc at will. Now, the Blacks were loving, kind, and good-willed, and didn't even know how to steal. They had harmonious assembly lines and knew their pecking orders up in their minds, showing no signs to find any reasons to punish or bind this wicked white race of their own mankind. Finally, finally, the Blacks made a stand and had to ban and demand that these whites leave their land. The whites wandered and roamed all over the lands, eating cats, rats, hyenas, and even man. Finding springs and fountains, landed their cells in the carcass mountains, dwelling in tunnels and caves, vowing to make Black slaves one of these days, making tools from sticks and stones and carcass bones, mad and rage at this stage, at having to leave the Blacks and facing animal attacks, making a pact that they would retaliate for this fate. And until this date, their anger has led to hate. with nothing in existence to ever measure it by. Evolution of hatred. And you wonder why? Blacks, we's naive to believe that mankind started from Adam and Eve. Blacks, beware when you see the blonde hair and blue eyes. Them's the monkeys that exterminate lives. That's it, Captain. You on mute. You on mute.
First of all, that was excellent. Excellent. And we really deeply appreciate it. And we're going to really put your book on recommended reading on the website, as Roger Key going to talk to you once we hang up, because I know you got to go pick up your son. And so, when you get a chance, because you got volume one, volume two, we're going to bring you back to do some poetry out of volume two and some of your experiences on the continent of Africa. But before we leave, Roger Key, you have any questions? You're on mute.
I want to thank him for bringing us this information. Poetry is off the hook. It's excellent. I mean, and you're just a natural. It's amazing. Sandra is on here. She's on here, and I wanted to see if she had anything to ask. She was here, and she's on here another time. You know, she's on here twice. So, Miss Sandra, Atiyah?
Tell her she on mute. I think
you're on mute. Do you have any questions or comments? Well, she's on here twice. I guess she's just listening. So, yeah, I'm just enjoying.
That's my friend. That's my good friend.
Okay.
Beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
My sister. That's my sister.
Well, oh, yeah, before you leave, tell us a little bit about your family members and your children.
Oh, okay. Well, as I explained to you about my elders, you know, they all came to California, and I wouldn't trade my life that I had for nothing on earth. Man, I got street knowledge, street schooling, everything that I could. But the main thing that I got is my mother's teaching. Man, I got ass whoopings, you understand? But what's going on right now is that I got two kids, one 25 and one is 14. And the 14-year-old, he plays three different instruments. He knows how to read music. But for some reason, he wants to get away from that and wants to play basketball. I told him, you can do both. We're not stopping you from doing anything. But son, you got too much time invested in this music for me not to let you just quit and drop it off like this. You know, well, he's been playing guitar and from the Marcus Garvey School and the Fernando Pullum Music Center over there at the school for since he was 5 years old. I can't just let you drop that off. So we got to figure out something, you know, where he can do both. So, you know, but he just broke his arm a few days ago trying to dunk, and somebody come up under him and knocked him down, knocked him off his balance, and he landed on his arm. Now he can't play the bass, you know. So, wow. And then my 25-year-old, his mother lives in Dubai. She is a Persian woman, you know, that we don't get along for nothing. But he himself actually has a t-shirt company, you know, like this hat I got on now, he did that. The shirt that I have, I don't know if you guys can see, it says Boo, the little black ghost. That's for blacks for outraged and outspoken and black owned and operated, you know. So we do have our own little merch and things that I've been doing. In those books, there's also some pictures and things with some of the things that I've done, you know.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Then you said more about your brothers and sisters.
Oh, okay. Well, so look, I got three older sisters. They was 20 years old when I was born. So two of them had passed on and joined the ancestors. I have one living sister, which is the baby sister. You know, in fact, my father himself was the baby of his family. He lived to be 90, you know. So my three sons, we're the only three forces left. You know, we don't have no more kids. Our family goes extinct, you know. But my sisters, I have nephews older than me in my age and nieces. And I love my family to death, man. I really do, you know. But the white man did a good job on us. You know, I have people, you know, tell me that I'm too black and really get angry with me, you know, about the way that I think and the way that I present myself. But I can't help it. You know, it is what it is, you know,
Brother Ronnie, you've come a long way. And I just want to commend you for writing the books and volume about you and the way you wrote them. You're trying to inspire people to wake up and realize that they are black people, that they are African people. And you embody a revolutionary thought, and the title of the book fits your mentality, because you are a true revolutionary. You're trying to revolutionize people's minds and spirit, and we deeply appreciate that. And next time you come on, we want to share some of your pictures from Ghana, and also we're going to share any other information that you want to bring, and we talked to Brother Omari. He know how to screen share. And we're going to get some screen sharing going on. And because we got to have you back, and we want to tell you this, you're welcome to come on this show anytime. Just give me a call. And you're welcome to come and listen to our programs that we have every Monday and Wednesday, which Rasha Key was going to tell you who's going to come on Wednesday. And we're going to try to get Brother Omari to talk about entrepreneurship and the challenge of Black people getting nonprofits and all those type of things with his experience with the Moja Group and all of that. And also the 12-step program that was very essential for your 33 years of sobriety. So we got a lot more to talk to you about, but we got to respect your time and respect your energy. And we just deeply appreciate the two poems that you read and make us want to listen to some more of them the next time you come on. So, Rasha Key, you
want to. And then I want to say this one thing, though.
Yeah.
If it don't be for Brother Omari, this book would not be produced. He stuck with me from A to Z.
I know. Yeah, I'm stuck with each other. That's a beautiful thing. All right. Brother Rasha Key, you want to tell them about what's on Wednesday and what's going on?
Okay, let me share the screen. Okay, we don't have a regular Wednesday show this week because I have a previous engagement I have to go to on Wednesday. Mm-hmm. So we're going to do it on Thursday.
Okay.
We got a brother coming on, Damian McCallman. He's a senior program coordinator for Elevate Your Game program. And he works, he comes to Centennial High School to one of my classes called Urban Scholars on Fridays. So he's going to tell us about the program, and we're going to, you know, talk with him. And then we have a special edition show right after that at 8:00, the Whisper Experience. It's a musical group that my cousin is a part of. And wait till you hear them. They sound really good. They do a real good job with the Whisper song. So that's going to be a real nice show. So that's what we have coming on Thursday. It's Thursday of this week. Okay. So, Professor Rob, who you got next on Monday?
What time Thursday?
We got Thursday at 6 and 8. Both shows. The first one is at 6, second one is at 8.
Okay. We're going to celebrate. Me and Brother Joe is going to talk about the celebration for our year, our first year anniversary of the show, and get some ideas from, you know, some other people. I'm going to try to get somebody else to speak, maybe Spencer Haywood or someone from Black Lives Matter, Brother Keeley, Vice President of the Los Angeles chapter. So we'll see. I'll let you know tomorrow morning. But anyway, Brother Ryan, again, you're welcome, you and Omari, to tune in. Like I said, you'll get a copy of this sent to you on your phone. And at the same time, it will be on YouTube. We need a picture of you that Omari can text to or email to Brother Rashiki, and he'll give you his number. That's what he want to talk to you about. And then so that when it comes on the YouTube, they have a picture of you and the title of the presentation that you want to give. So we're going to let you go ahead, brother, and talk to Rasha Key. But Rasha Key, thanks for everything, all right? And I'm going to sign off. But at the same time, go ahead and talk to Brother Ronnie right quick and get the information.
And thank you too, Professor, very, very much, man. You know you hold a special place in my heart. Man,
this is dynamic, brother. This is dynamic. Having you on the show, life is up. You know. Go back and win some more money and go back another country. All right, I'll get with y'all.
Professor, I was good seeing you. Good seeing Joe. I go all the way back to Walton Junior High School with Joe, and he's just been one solid brother for as long as I've known him. And of course, Rashiki, we grew up in the same neighborhood.
But let me tell you this: you know Captain Shahid passed.
Yeah,
big Cap. Okay, so we plan to have the service on the 28th. It's a debate whether it's going to be at the house of the Minora Jones place, House of Refuge, or either at Compton College. The wife wanted it at Compton College. The son wanted it at the House of Refuge. So they got to work that out. All right, I'll get back to you, brother.
All right, each one, conscious one.
Right. Stay on.